The Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the Church in the world. And we just say, just do it. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. This is the week of Thanksgiving, and Thanksgiving is one of those really, really great holidays. It's actually my favorite holiday. It's it's actually more than just Thursday of Thanksgiving, because everybody's getting ready, everybody's afterwards, and so it's just a great time of the year. Angie, what's your favorite part about Thanksgiving?
I think just everybody making food and coming together. And then I know it's so cheesy, but when they all talk about what they're thankful for, it really makes me emotional, but in a good way. I'm like, oh, guys, I love you.
Oh, isn't that nice?
Are you not buying it?
No, I'm buying it.
That's true. And the apple pies.
Apple pies. Turkey's my favorite. Turkey's my favorite kind of meal of the year, except for pizza.
Really? But, oh, pizza's all the time.
Yeah, pizza's all the time.
Pizza and ice cream.
Pizza and ice cream, but turkey is a really, really good thing. I only learned a few years ago that it's got that thing in it that makes you sleepy. What is it called? Anybody know?
Oh, it starts with an E, but that's why I think...
Or a T.
Tryptophan?
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Yeah, you're right. It is an E. No, T. Sorry.
Well, it's close. That was kind of makes you thirst. That makes you sleepy mm-hmm. after it. And so it's. But Thanksgiving is really, really, really a great holiday. It's got a lot of characteristics which I think make it great. I mean, one of it is it's not a big gift giving holiday, so that it's not so much about, you know, presents and gifts and stuff like that. It's about the people. Mm-hmm. It's about other people. So I think that's what makes it great. It's also one of those things which is kind of a holiday that everybody in the whole United States celebrates. It's not a particular religion. It's not a particular ethnicity. It's kind of pretty much a national holiday in which everybody does it. Now, the negative side about it is the traveling is crazy because everybody's traveling, and that makes it a little bit difficult. So, but it's a great holiday. It is a great, great holiday, and we'll talk a little bit more about it later on in the show. But we have two guests this week who kind of are going to speak to us from very different parts of the world. Our first guest is actually from South Africa, and I'm going to be speaking with him about some of the things going on there to reduce some of the illnesses that are there. And then, appropriately for kind of the Thanksgiving time, later on the show, we're going to speak with somebody who kind of formed an organization to rescue food so that food doesn't go to waste and that it can be used to help hungry people. So let's suggest, I'd say we go to our first guest, who is Frank Beadle de Paloma, who is the president and chief executive officer of Mothers to Mothers. And Frank, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Great. And, happy Thanksgiving week to you.
Thank you. We're really getting excited to my family to celebrate something. We'll do it on Friday, not Thursday, but we're excited about it.
Okay, that is great. Now, you're actually in South Africa, aren't you?
Yes, I'm based in Cape Town.
Now, I guess, there's no Thanksgiving Day for South Africans, right? I mean, it's not, maybe there is, but it's, so tell, is there a Thanksgiving Day for South Africans?
So there is something fairly similar. It's the National Heritage Day, and it's a time where folks from different cultures, different ethnicities, think about their role, their cultures in a very complex society in South Africa, and it's often traditional foods are served, folks with traditional dress. It's actually a very lovely holiday.
And what time of the year is that celebrated?
That's usually, I'm going to mess that up, I think it's in September.
Okay, so it's, it's a day which has some of the characteristics of Thanksgiving Day. Now, you grew up in the United States, right?
I grew up in the United States and spent quite a bit of time back and forth in Mexico as well.
Okay, so so that's how you kind of get the Thanksgiving thing, that it's part of the kind of American United States experience, even though if in certain other parts of the country it's not. So, well, I hope that you have a great, you know, Thanksgiving with your family. So let's talk a little bit about the organization that you're working with and some of the work that you're doing. Tell our listeners about Mothers to Mothers.
So Mothers to Mothers is an African-based organization that started in 2001, and our focus is on eliminating mother-to-child transmission of HIV and ensuring that HIV-positive mothers have thriving, successful lives and that their children are both born HIV-negative and that they're supported to the point that when they're ready to become adults, that they remain negative and were actually able to end the AIDS epidemic.
Now, how'd that idea, who came up with the idea?
So our founder is Dr. Mitch Besser, an American who was practicing in San Diego, California at the time. He's an OBGYN and had been to South Africa before. In high school, had decided to come back and move here with his family. And while he was practicing in one of our large hospitals, actually Sitges Skure, where the Dr. Christian Bernard with the first artificial heart pioneered that innovation, Mitch started realizing that in the Western world, where we had basically eliminated pediatric AIDS transmission infections, he realized that they had the meds here, there was access, but there just wasn't a process. There wasn't both a cultural sensitive or an innovative way to be able to both deliver the message, have women get tested, and access treatment. And so he realized and quickly found that women who were HIV positive, who had successfully gone through what's called prevention of mother-to-child transmission, PMTCT, the treatment, that they would become really, really wonderful peers and mentor models for other HIV-positive pregnant women. And that is really the power of our program, is we identify, we educate and professionalize and employ HIV-positive women who've gone through PMTCT, and they work with HIV-positive pregnant women in public health clinics from about 4 months of pregnancy till the time the child is 18 months old.
We're speaking with Frank Beto de Paloma, who is the president and chief executive officer of Mothers to Mothers, which is an organization working to eliminate the transmission of AIDS from mother to child. For our listeners, Frank, so I guess there's got to be a certain awareness that the mother does have the HIV virus in order to kind of take steps to deal with it?
Yes. So in antenatal clinics, when women come in and they're often very excited about an upcoming pregnancy, they either think or they know that they're pregnant, when they enter into public health facilities, they are actually tested for HIV. And our mentor mothers partner with them upon that initial diagnosis and help transform what could be a devastating, really a change in their life into something that they're able to both manage, grow through, and have really positive outcomes with.
You know, I'm not sure that I don't know the specifics of it, but I do know that periodically in the United States, the issue of privacy, civil liberties, et cetera, and some of the mandating testing stuff has come across or come run up against some of those issues. Is there any issue of that in the work you're doing in South Africa?
I mean, there's always the question of, in terms of privacy and protecting individual status, stigma, although much, much, much reduced in Southern Africa, is still an issue. And so individuals need to be supported to disclose at their own rate and as they feel comfortable to do so. So we work in a lot of confidential situations. Oftentimes, the partner of one of our clients might not know that she's positive, or she might not know that her partner's positive. So we spend a lot of time on disclosure, education, and supporting. that process to make sure that it is something that our clients both accept and that they're supported within their family structures.
And you find that, you know, even though in some cases it's probably a great deal of work, at the end of the day, it tends to be pretty successful, the work, and people are willing to kind of communicate, disclose when they learn the information.
Yes, and I would say that it's actually, of all the work I've ever done in my life, it's the most amazing and rewarding. And every day when I get to interact with our mentor mothers, and we have about 1,300 mentor mothers across 7 countries in sub-Saharan Africa, you hear these amazing stories of the transformation that both they've gone through, but also their clients. And in one of our clinics here in Khayelitsha Township outside of Cape Town, I met one of our clients who was talking to our mentor mothers in a support group, and I asked her why she was coming to the program, why she was so faithful to the program, why she had disclosed to her partner and her family. And she put her hand on her stomach and she said, "This baby, this could be the next Nelson Mandela. I have a responsibility to make sure that he or she has that opportunity." And it's those kinds of stories that just touch your heart and you realize that what we're doing is not just health, it's transformational.
We're speaking with Frank Beadle de Paloma, the President and Chief Executive Officer of Mothers to Mothers, an organization dedicated to eliminating the transmission of HIV to children by their mothers. You know, for somebody like myself who is not a doctor, and I think a lot of our listeners are not, so what happens? So somebody comes in, a woman comes in, and she is HIV positive, and she's pregnant. Well, and she says, "Well, help me." How do you help her? What's the quote-unquote treatment in order to prevent the transmission of the disease to her child?
So one of the key things is to make sure that she's actually initiated on what are called antiretrovirals. And they are a class, a cocktail of medications, of drugs, that are used across the world. And they help to suppress the viral load, so the amount of HIV in the body. And the client, the mom, can take these medications safely during pregnancy and will take them post-pregnancy. And most countries we work on, once you've been identified as positive, you begin your treatment for life. And then the key issue is to make sure that she stays healthy, that she gets the right nutrition, that if there are comorbidities such as tuberculosis, that that is treated as well, and that if there is a potential for a complication in the birth, if she has preeclampsia, if the baby's breech, that we are clear about whether she needs to have a cesarean or ensuring that she at least has an expert or a skilled birth attendant with her. And then post-delivery, it's really important we do a test of the baby to make sure that that baby is either positive, to make sure the baby's either negative and that the baby's okay. And if that baby's positive, we get that child on treatment as well. There's a second test that we do at 18 months that also makes sure that if the baby is positive on their own, that we understand that they're positive and it's not just the mother's antibodies. And if the child's negative, we then also help make sure that that child has access to support to help them thrive. And I think the interesting process here is the drugs are a key piece. You mentioned disclosure and privacy. We find that disclosure is a key motivating factor in the work that we do, in that women who disclose to their partner and to their immediate family members, they are more adherent to taking their medications, and it's really critical that an HIV-positive woman, pregnant or not, that she continues to take her medications to suppress her viral load. But also, if she discloses, we're also able to help that family structure. Her partner is most likely HIV positive. There might be other children or other family members that are HIV positive. We can get them tested, and if they're positive, we can get them on care. And that's how, as kind of a network spoke process, we're able to network out and not just treat our clients and their child, but to actually work with a whole family.
So you just said something which I want to explore a little bit further, that you know, whether the woman was pregnant or not. And I guess the question I'd like to learn a little bit more about myself is, what you described is what you would do, I would think, with any person who was found to be positive, HIV positive. You'd begin to put them on drugs to kind of prolong their life, et cetera, et cetera. But do you do anything else with a pregnant woman to prevent the transmission of diseases?
Yes. So, okay. And then just to make sure that I'm clear on this issue, that in the past, we used to wait for a certain amount of what are called CD4 cells in the body to drop to a certain level, and these are part of your immune system. And so you would only take medications once your CD4 cells had dropped to a certain level. But now, with new understanding of the epidemic, more understanding of the virus, we actually are, in most countries, it's supporting that an HIV-positive woman during pregnancy, that she start her medications regardless of her CD4 count and continue through life. So the treatment is a key piece of this and making sure that she stays adherent to her treatment. The second piece is making sure that she's engaged in her health care so that she is coming in for all her required prenatal visits and that she has very specific care, that her doctor is providing her with certain support. The third piece that's really important is that once the baby's born, is that mom is supported to make a decision about either exclusive breastfeeding or exclusive infant formula feeding. And it's important that she not mix, because it's in the mixing and not being exclusive that she then potentially exposes her child to HIV again.
We're speaking with Frank Beto de Paloma, the president and CEO of Mothers to Mothers, an organization dedicated to eliminating the transmission of HIV virus from a mother to her child. Frank, you've been at this for a while, and you've been successful, right?
Yes, the organization started in 2001. We have reached, by the end of 2016, we will have reached more than 1.5 million HIV-positive women. And when we started in 2001, specifically in South Africa, the transmission rate was in the upper 30%. And that's quite an incredible number to think about.
So translate that for our listeners. What does that mean? For every 100 mothers who got pregnant, 30 of their kids would have HIV/AIDS?
For every 100 HIV-positive women who got pregnant, about 35 to 38% of them were transmitting to their child. They would be positive.
Okay.
And now we are at a point where in South Africa alone, we are below 2.5% transmission rate.
That's fantastic. In fact,
Mothers to Mothers is really excited. The UNAIDS has a campaign and a process, a benchmark for what's called virtual elimination, which would be seeing transmission rates that are below 5%. And we're very, very proud to say that among our cohort, our clients in our six countries, we've actually achieved virtual elimination.
Wow, that is a phenomenal number. And how extensive is it? I mean, obviously, I mean, this is a silly comment, but there are millions upon millions of people in Africa, and there are many, many pregnant. How extensive has Mothers to Mothers been able to kind of do its programming?
So in the six countries in which we operate, and we have a seventh that we've just started services in Zambia, but in our six countries, we see one in four HIV-positive women, they deliver their babies through support with a Mothers to Mothers mentor mother.
Okay.
And so that's a one in four ratio. And so our reach, our scale is quite impressive. And again, as I mentioned, having reached by the end of next year, about 1.5 million HIV-positive women. The second real indicator that we have on our effectiveness, I mentioned that our virtual elimination, but last year we also did an external evaluation of our programs to look at the cost effectiveness. And we found, for example, in Uganda, that for every dollar that's spent on our mentor mother model, we are able to document a savings of $11.40 of averted treatment costs.
Wow, that is phenomenal. You know why I always like to talk about things like this, Frank? And I do think, you know, I'll plead guilty myself. I certainly think that those of us in the United States of America, you know, there's the internet, there's all of international stuff, but we still got these two big oceans on either side of us. And I think sometimes, you know, we kind of focus almost, not exclusively, but a whole lot on what's going on in our country, which is understandably, and everything else becomes a little bit like a very mysterious, we don't know a lot about it. And I think particularly that's the case with many of us with regard to Africa. And you know, we got an image of Africa as, you know, a lot of poverty, a lot of disease, a lot of warfare, a lot of violence, all of those type of things. And sometimes it seems so big that it's helpless. We can't do anything about it. So I love to let people understand what you're doing, organizations like yours. We actually got a lot of success so that we can make the world a better place.
And it's very exciting as well that I would say that that is something that we tend to do. And I know having lived in America or wherever we live, we tend to focus on our backyard or what's closest to us. I will say that the United States has been an amazing supporter, not just of this program, but really the battle to end the AIDS epidemic. And whether it's been through the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief or major foundations and family foundations and just individuals that have supported this, and they understand the work that our organization and others are doing. And I think our work specifically in terms of focusing on women, empowering women, and understanding that the support and the health that we are focusing on for our clients, it transforms into healthier families, which means healthier communities, which means healthier societies. And I do think that that is a focus that we can keep folks remembering, that HIV is, and especially mother-to-child transmission, this is a completely preventable part of the epidemic. We can actually beat this. And I think it makes folks feel good when you can actually wrap your hands around the program and you see the impact. And it is about moms and infants. It's about children. It's about adolescents. And it's about families.
Hey, Frank, thank you so much. Is there a website that people can go to so if they want to learn more about your organization and what's going on that they can kind of follow it?
Definitely. And we have our website and our organization. It's Mothers to Mothers is our organization. And our website is mothers2mothers.org.
Hey, that's pretty creative. You got that one right.
Actually, yeah, mtm.org. It's a very easy
right.
one. Very
okay. Easy. And actually, to our listeners, it's two as in the number two there. So it's mothers2mothers.org. And as I always do on these things, I just Google it because I can never remember the URLs, but we get there. Hey, Frank, hey, have a great Thanksgiving with you and your family. And thanks so much for the work that you're doing and sharing that with our listeners. Boy, I know this is something that we should be thankful for this Thanksgiving. Frank DeBeetle, De Paloma, President and Chief Executive Officer of Mothers to Mothers. Thanks for being with us, Frank.
Thank you so much, Monsignor, and thank you to your listeners.
Great. So, you know what, Angie, Tom, I think we'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll kind of continue our conversation on Just Love, and just do it. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love, the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about what the church is doing in the world and what's going on in our world. And this week of Thanksgiving, we, you know, have a lot to give thankful for. But, you know, what I kind of Thanksgiving, every year we kind of celebrate Thanksgiving when we come around, and it's one of the kind of the warmest and most universal greetings that we have. It, you know, we say it to everybody, Happy Thanksgiving, and it's just such a warm feeling. And we kind of do it every year. However, every year when we do it, there's something that is new. And we bring with us, as we celebrate Thanksgiving, our recent experiences. And sometimes the more recent ones, because we remember them better, are more in our heads. And I think when we do Thanksgiving, we do things both individually and kind of as a community, so that we bring things as a community that we share. And this year, a lot of stuff was both disturbing and inspiring. I think, you know, for all of us in the whole world, this Thanksgiving, it's just too near to those awful criminal murderous terror attacks in Paris that were just so disturbing to all of us. And, you know, in the United States, we're also listening to some of the presidential campaign and some of the rhetoric, which is really not very edifying. Some of the vocabulary and some of the rhetoric of that is just not something that we'd want to raise up to be imitated. And yet, on the other hand, we're still in the afterglow of that most inspiring visit of Pope Francis when he came to the United States. So, and we bring all of that as a people to our Thanksgiving. And so that's part of what we kind of are part of our giving thanks about. Not that we give thanks for some of those, but it's the context of which we do. And then, so that's what we do as a community. But when we do come together, we also come together with our own individual things. I mean, the births in our families, the deaths in our families, you know, some of the new attachments and maybe some of the betrayals that are there too. And, you know, and we deal with illness and sometimes just as positive at exaltation, at successful surgeries or treatment. And then, you know, when there's an illness that's like long term and it's debilitating, that's also part of what we bring. And then, you know, drugs, they miraculously heal. And then they're an addicting scourge for, you know, for other people. So that's what we all bring to it. And, it, you know, it's a little bit more than saying it's the best of times, it's the worst of time. The glass is half empty, the glass is half filled. All of that is true, but it's the whole context for our Thanksgiving. I got to tell you, though, one of the things that I bring with me this Thanksgiving was, and I don't do this a lot, but I did this year. I was listening to the American Music Awards. And I didn't watch the whole thing, but I was watching kind of towards the end of it. And, you know, there was a lot of stuff going on there in which there was recognition of the recent terror attacks, the deaths in Paris. And the thing that I really got moved by, and, you know, I don't know if we can, was the ending of that in which there was this wonderful, I don't know if tribute is the right word, in which Celine Dion did this hymn to love, which is an old Edith Piaf song, which was very personal to Edith Piaf, but it also has kind of, in a symbolic way, can deal with a lot of different things. And she kind of sung that as her tribute to the solidarity and with the people of Paris and of France because of that. And what I was most amazed by that, and it was in French, and I don't really understand French, but, you know, you pick up a word here or there, and then I looked it up to figure out what it meant. But what I found so amazing by the whole thing is it was done magnificently. It was haunting. And at the end, as she ends the song, everybody stands, and it's a standing applause, whatever, and there's great emotion in the room, and I couldn't see them, but there are 10 million people watching. but the song ends with these two phrases. Can we believe that we can love one another? and God reunites those who love each other. And what, with a little bit of irony, I thought it was just such a magnificent thing that everybody's cheering and standing. And because it was mostly an American audience there, they probably didn't understand the words. And it was the glitterati of Hollywood who was there, who probably, you know, I would say their proportion of people who are show up in churches on Sunday is probably not the highest and, you know, stuff like that. There's great spirituality and soul sometimes, but it was just, to me, so wonderful that can we love one another, and God reunites those who love one another, gets a standing ovation. I just thought it was so wonderful. And I kind of thought that, you know, God has a little bit of a stealth behavior, that sometimes God kind of sneaks in, you know, maybe in a little baby or in a little carpenter or in a song, and God shows up in places where sometimes we least expect God to show up. So anyway, but that was one of the things that I was really, really moved by this past week, because it was a wonderful kind of tribute of solidarity. And all there in the midst of this incredibly, really, it is a secular song. It ends with a ringing tribute to the power of God in using love to bring people together. And I just thought it was just a wonderful thing that was part of that. So, Tom, it is kind of Thanksgiving week. You got any facts about Thanksgiving or things that maybe we want to share? Maybe some that people know, some that people don't know.
Well, you know, Monsignor, I was going to say one of the things that, according to Gallup, this year, 9 out of 10 Americans, or 284 million out of 316 million total, ate with family and friends. So, as you said, almost everyone in the country participates in Thanksgiving. And according to the American Farm Bureau.
Yeah, but what about 10%? What are they up to?
You know, I don't know. That's what I was kind of wondering, too, because I kind of thought everyone celebrated Thanksgiving, but maybe they only count people who actually travel. Maybe there are people who are shut-ins.
Well, maybe there are the others who, the hard-working people.
Yes.
Like Angie, who has to
that's right, who has to work on Thanksgiving.
To make sure
that's correct,
we can be entertained and get good things going.
You're
on.
Welcome, everybody.
Well, we're just so grateful for your working to do that. So, all right. So, what else you got, Tom?
Just the American Farm Bureau also was talking about the amount that the average household spends on Thanksgiving.
Oh, you told me about this. I don't believe you.
Yeah, I know. They said it was $49, Monsignor. Now, I find that a little bit low. But they said it's up 37 cents from last year. They said it's mostly because of the increase from dairy products, coffee, and sweet potatoes. But they said that if you had wanted, that Whole Food Markets actually produced a whole Thanksgiving dinner for 12 for $170. So it seems to me that, you know, for $170, only for three times the cost of what it would cost to do it yourself, you could feed a whole gang of people. So I wasn't quite sure.
Well, didn't it say $49 a household?
$49 per household. So
you probably got four people in there.
That's what I'm thinking. Okay. So, I mean, that's probably what the story is.
All right. You get a Big Mac or two. Right?
That's for sure.
For four or something. You get that.
Okay. Exactly.
What else we got for Thanksgiving?
For Thanksgiving, Thanksgiving is also the second... it's the holiday that people spend the second most money on here, according to the National Retail Federation, their survey of consumer spending.
All right, so now you got this. I got to interrupt you because listen, too many stores are opening on Thanksgiving Eve to do Christmas shop, but there were few of them that kind of pushed back.
Yes, there were. There were ones here.
I don't remember which ones.
REI is one. I know they're the ski shop. They announced that they were going to wind up staying closed on Thanksgiving evening. And I know there were several others I saw. And actually, I have to say, in social media, Monsignor, on Facebook, a lot of the stores that decided to announce they stay closed got such good responses from people. People are not, I think, you know, everyone was saying hooray, hooray, hooray for staying closed, because I don't think it's really very fair for folks who actually want to celebrate Thanksgiving with their family that they have to get up from their meal and they have to go to work on the night of Thanksgiving. It's, you know, to me, it's un-American.
Well, I think that's true. I think that's a real reality. I actually know a family that has to work on Thanksgiving. And I think they're in the service industry, or I don't know exactly what. But so what they're doing is they're celebrating Thanksgiving today.
Ah,
their big Thanksgiving meal is today, the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. So that's when they're doing Thanksgiving. So that's one way to do it. But I think that is right. It's not a good it's not good. I think, you know, I don't see any problem with opening the store on 5 a.m. on the Friday after Thanksgiving. That's, you know, the early bird catches the worm, or
right.
something like that. Isn't that American? Benjamin Franklin, yes, or something
that is,
like that?
That's right. Yeah,
I don't know, but I don't.
Founding father.
Yeah. actually, you know, just for our listeners throughout the country, for those of us in the New York area, that whole notion of, do you close stores on Sunday, and they used to be called the Blue Laws. I'm not sure why they're called the Blue Laws, but anyway. But you know, they've pretty much gone by the wayside, except there is a county in right outside of New York City, over in New Jersey, Bergen County, which still has their Blue Laws. And Bergen County has lots and lots of shops and stores along the main places there. And, you know, on a usual sad day, you never want to travel through there because it's just a lot of traffic. Mm-hmm. It's crazy, crazy, crazy. However, you always want to do it on Sunday because all the stores are closed and you can just zip through there. So it's kind of those of us in the New York metropolitan area who go through that part of Jersey, we're still familiar with that concept of Blue Laws because it's so out of the ordinary for the rest of the metropolitan area. But you realize that it's there. So any other fun fact about Thanksgiving, Tom?
Thanksgiving, Monsignor? I would say, you know, as I said, well, one of the interesting things, the original Thanksgiving, for folks who may not be aware, was a 3-day harvest festival, not just one day. And the exact date is lost to history, but they know it happened somewhere between September 21st and November 11th.
It happened on the third Thursday of November. I guarantee that's when it happened, or the fourth Thursday of November. I mean, that's when
that's why we hold it on that day, right? I would say.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was interesting. 59 colonists attended and 90 Wampanoag Native Americans.
Okay.
And what they did was, at the time, Plymouth Governor William Bradford sent four of the what we call pilgrim men out to hunt for the local bird, which is obviously where we get the wild turkey from. But the Wampanoag brought venison from 5 deer.
Wow.
So there was a lot of food, a lot of meat, a lot of good stuff going on at that time.
You know,
so
we could maybe use Jesus, a little bit of multiplication of the deer and the birds to feed 100, 200 people. What do we got? 59 and 100, a lot of people, right?
Yeah, there was about 150 people at the original Thanksgiving. Wow. But it lasted 3 days, so they needed a lot of food.
Wow, okay. Did they have anything to drink?
That I did not see. I'm sure
they did,
Monsignor. Well, at least they would have had water, right?
All right, let's take a break. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we're delighted that we're going to speak with our guest, Robert Lee, who is with us here in the studio. Robert, thank you for being here. And he's the co-founder of Rescuing Leftover Cuisine, and a lot of that on Thanksgiving. So I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just love. Just love your neighbor, love yourself, love God, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us when we come back in just 2 minutes, and we'll talk about how we rescue leftover cuisine. This is the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. This is Thanksgiving week, and we're kind of talking about things that maybe we should be grateful for. And we spoke about the reduction of the transmission of AIDS between mother and child in South Africa, and that was a really uplifting conversation about the reduction there. And Thanksgiving, we couldn't not include a segment on Just Love about food at Thanksgiving. I mean, that's what it's known for, food. And so I'm delighted, though, that we're going to speak about a specific aspect of food with Robert Lee, the co-founder and CEO at Rescuing Leftover Cuisine. And Robert, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Great. And thanks for coming in on this Thanksgiving week. You know, Thanksgiving week, Thanksgiving is probably one of those days in which there is probably more leftover food on Thanksgiving than almost anything else. So, let me get right into it. Is there anything special that Rescuing Leftover Cuisine is doing for Thanksgiving?
We actually have done a couple of stuff maybe about last week, and trying to continue to do some more stuff coming up. But basically, last week we had provided some turkeys to a homeless shelter in downtown Manhattan.
Okay.
So that they could do a Thanksgiving dinner at the New York City Rescue Mission. One of our partners thankfully supplied those donations. We were also doing a bunch of food drives throughout the city and provided over, we don't have the final count yet, but we have thousands of cans of food.
That's great. So let's back up a little bit and talk a little bit about what the organization is, how it got started, and kind of what's your idea for the organization. So you actually were the one who started this organization, weren't you?
Yeah, one of the few, yeah.
Okay, so tell us about it.
Sure. So Rescuing Leftover Cuisine is basically pretty self-explanatory, even though it's a very long name. But basically what we do is we take excess food from many different places, food suppliers, pretty much every single type of food supply you could think of on the supply chain, including farms, wholesalers, retailers, restaurants, catering companies, and corporations. And we take that food that's about to be thrown away, and we take that food to the people who need it at different agencies like food banks, food pantries, soup kitchens, and homeless shelters.
So is the food that you rescue, is it usually, primarily, sometimes, is it cooked food, already prepared food, or is it kind of boxes and cans of food? Which is it?
It's all kinds. So, okay. For example, from farms, we usually get just produce, things that were not picked up, right. things that were gleaned. But we also get things from restaurants, such as macaroni and cheese, things that were prepared.
Okay. And, I know a little bit about this kind of area. Tell listeners about, like, some of the issues in terms of how do you rescue kind of prepared food?
Yeah. There's a whole bunch of issues.
Okay.
People always believe that it's illegal.
Right.
But it's actually protected by federal law and state law. There's a Bill Emerson Good Samaritan Act of 1996 that basically protects food donors from legal liability if the food is donated in good faith, except in the case of gross negligence, which is basically extreme carelessness. Like if you throw the food on the ground and then donate it, that's obviously not okay. But all the food that we get donated is safe, packaged, edible, clean. And would have been supplied to customers, except that the restaurant or place is closing for the day.
So we're celebrating Thanksgiving this week. I think, probably if you asked people, leftover food is like, we had a bowl of string beans and we only used 3/4 of it.
Right.
And can we rescue that quarter pound of string beans a day? That's not what you're talking about, is it?
Unfortunately, no. But the fact is that we can do so much more with food waste than we think of right now. Because, even if we can't take food from people's plates, because obviously that's contaminated and it's been touched,
right.
There's so much more that can be done with it, such as composting, such as animal feed. You know, there's so many other things that can be used, you know, instead of going to the landfills, which is currently doing.
Okay. So let's go. So we're not talking about, you know, if I don't eat my full portion of vegetables that you're going to rescue. We're not talking about that.
Unfortunately, no.
Okay. So, but what are we talking? If you're working with a restaurant, how do they have leftover food?
Yeah, so the restaurant would produce, they expect X number of customers.
Okay.
Sometimes they produce more because they expect more demand, but sometimes that's wrong. And sometimes they produce way too much and they have, you know, just too many. For example, at bakeries, they just have too many pastries.
Right.
They can't sell all of them. Same deal with restaurants. They produce too much soup and they don't want to throw it out. And so they take that and they package it up safely and they provide it to us and we can take it to the people who need it.
It seems to me that's a great idea to do that.
Very great.
And it also seems to me it's probably pretty intricate to organize and labor intensive and all those types of things. How do you get it all together?
Yeah, it's the main problem is always logistics and transportation because the fact of the matter is that we have so much food waste in this country. We have 40% of the food that we produce in this country is wasted. While at the same time, 1 in 7 Americans are food insecure.
Right.
And it makes no sense that food waste that ends up in landfills is producing methane gases, which are 20 times worse than carbon dioxide.
Right.
And is one of the contributing factors to climate change.
Right.
And so the concept of bringing the food from place to place is just connecting those two endpoints with the transportation solution that will provide for, you know, bringing the food from place to place.
Is there economies of scale? I mean,
I mean, so the main thing is, you know, having the people, what we do, there's a lot of food rescue organizations out there in the country that do amazing work and do an amazing job of transporting food from place to place. And what Rescuing La Cuisine does is we try to kind of crowdsource the solution and allow for the public to get engaged, bring their own vehicles, bring their own kind of help to the work and provide the transportation between place to place.
Give me an example.
Sure. So in New York City, for example, it's a very unique, very compact environment. So what we have—
You grew up in New York City,
yes,
didn't you?
Yeah.
I grew up in the New York area, too. So we kind of think this is normal. This is normal.
And then I'm shocked when it's like
I mean, spread out. All of this green grass and stuff like that, that's abnormal. You know, you know, there are some states that like Texas, they think that's normal to have all that space. I mean, you know, but
no, it's great.
But some of them actually, some of those people actually learn and they come and they move to New York and the Lower East Side, and then they kind of
they
get it right.
But yeah, in New York City, like in Lower East Side, for example, we have, you know, a bunch of homeless shelters and soup kitchens, and we have volunteers that come to the restaurants and they're able to walk the food from place to place. And And if it's more heavy, if it's heavier, and they can provide carts, they can provide cars, they can provide sometimes pickup trucks and larger trucks. And so that that type of model of kind of crowdsourcing the solution out to the public is able allows RLC to not bear that cost of actually owning the vehicles, paying for all the insurance, et cetera, et cetera.
We're speaking with Robert Lee, who is the co-founder, the CEO of Rescuing Leftover Cuisine, and we're speaking about the fact that, boy, if we could kind of connect all the food that's being produced here with all the food that's not being eaten and wasted, we could deal with the fact that the millions of people in this country who don't have good food and an adequate meal all the time could be doing a lot better. So Robert, I'm interested that when you're talking about, again, I'm a little obsessed with this because I think that's what our listeners are about.
Yeah.
When they think about wasted food, they say, oh, I didn't eat my portion, I throw it out. But that's not what you're talking about.
No.
Maybe it's a little bit of it, but the big thing is how in our production system of food, we waste food.
Right.
How do we do that?
How do we waste food?
Yeah.
It's really—
Because, I mean, this is the United States. We are a market economy.
Yeah.
It would seem to me that the people who are doing this food stuff don't want to waste it because they lose money.
Yeah, there's so many reasons why we waste food. from the kind of production level down, in the farms, a lot of farms basically have standards for the food that they produce.
Uh-huh.
And if it's not shaped a certain way, if it's not meeting their lengths or whatever sizes, or even aesthetically pleasing, then they'll basically be throwing it back in the compost or throwing it out. Okay. As it moves down, those kind of restrictions and those kind of standards get more restrictive. And on wholesalers, they basically have huge assembly lines, and they pick out the fruits and vegetables that are just not beautiful or right. not, you know, adhering to their standards. And then at the grocery stores, we are, you know, ourselves, we go to the grocery stores and then we pick out the best ones because every single one of the products right. costs the same. So clearly we're going to take the best one out of the ones right. That are displayed. So even at restaurants, the portion sizes, there's so many different reasons why food waste exists.
Well, what's the solution? I mean, not the global, but what's one of the solutions to one piece of the waste?
I think a broad solution would be awareness and just thinking about different ways we can use food waste. Because food waste, if you think about it, is food itself is life.
Right.
And if we are wasting 40% of the food that we produce, that means that that cow or that chicken yeah. could have lived.
Well, let me push you a little bit. So because our listeners do practical. So if I'm going to the store and I'm looking at an avocado,
yeah,
and I'm going to pick the one that I like,
yeah, exactly.
that feels good.
Mm-hmm.
But if I don't do that, how am I going to?
Yeah,
that's not going to
right.
save
food.
So
on the consumer side, what we can do to help reduce food waste is basically make sure that we're not shopping hungry, for
okay.
example.
Okay.
And whatever we do shop for, we are actually going to use because oftentimes I often do this myself. I just look at things and I say, oh, this is great. I'm going to buy it. Or if this is a really great deal, I have to buy it.
Right.
But what we should keep in mind is that, you know, this is food and we have to make sure that if we buy it, we have to use it.
Okay. That's good. We have just another minute left. So that's one tip for our listeners. Give our listeners one more idea what they can do
yeah.
to deal with food waste.
Sure. So within Rescue My Cuisine, we have a large need for volunteers.
Okay.
And our two main pain points right now is funding and volunteers. And we need the people to help bring the food from place to place. We have a waiting list of actually food suppliers that want to donate food to us, but we don't have enough people who are willing to actually bring their their time and the resources out to help us bring the food from place to place.
You have a website?
So people can actually sign up on our website to volunteer at rescuingleftovercuisine.org/calendar. And they can sign up for whatever time slots they want. We have opportunities every single day, 7 days a week, at every hour of the day between 10 a.m. and midnight. So anyone can pretty much sign up, whenever they want.
I want to know, do you get leftovers from Insomnia Cookies?
No. We actually did talk to them. Unfortunately, you can't get anybody.
You know, but somebody might want to volunteer at 3 o'clock in the morning, and you get the leftovers from Insomnia Cookies.
We did talk to them.
Robert Lee, the co-founder of Rescuing Leftover Cuisine.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you for what you're doing and pointing out to our listeners that, you know, there is a lot of food out there, but we're not connecting the dots in terms of getting it there. So, hey, this is a great opportunity for listeners to think about it. It's not about the leftover string beans on your plate. It's thinking a little bit more globally about how we don't waste food, we use food, and we try to connect the dots with regard to it. You know, Tom, I think Thanksgiving is one of those days in which we think a lot about food. And I just want to talk positively because so many people are generous with their neighbors this time. It's one of the things I give thanks for. As people say, well, it's only Thanksgiving. No, but it is Thanksgiving. And so let's give thanks to God. We give thanks to our neighbors. We give thanks for one another. This is Just Love. Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourselves, and our world will be a more just and compassionate place. Join us next week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.